case of the day, Bednarski v. the United States. Mr. Brandt.
May it please the court, Mr. Connell. My name is Jeff Brandt, representing John Bednarski. This morning, Mr. Bednarski, a 69 or 70-year-old gentleman, Navy veteran, at about the age of 67, 68, with no criminal conduct for 40 years. The only criminal conduct they could find was a disorderly conduct back in 59. Frankly, committed a pretty awful offense. He pleaded guilty to an amended information charging him with knowingly possessing on a computer hard drive pictures of minors engaged in sexually explicit conduct. Led to believe first by an FBI agent that suggested that the case wasn't going anywhere. Maybe that meant nowhere at all. Maybe it meant nowhere in federal court. Maybe the case would be taken in state courts where it might be as harshly. And then in large part by counsel that a 9-guideline sentence was possible and possibly even probation or parole, Mr. Bednarski was surprised and disappointed by his sentence. He sought advice, and we submit he didn't get that advice, leading to the 2255 motion. Our brief sets forth two errors we believe the district court made, the first being taking into consideration Mr. Bednarski's inability to specify an issue that could win on appeal, and then separate, distinct, finding that Mr. Bednarski's attorney gave sufficient advice to fulfill his duty under Flores-Ortega. Admittedly, Mr. Bednarski was really candid with counsel and really candid with the district court. He did not directly ask for an appeal. But we submit the record is very clear that he was disappointed with the sentence, that he believed another and shorter sentence was, in the words of his counsel, very, very, very likely, and that his duty, his counsel's duty to give him advice failed to meet the standard of Flores-Ortega. Flores-Ortega tells us counsel has a duty if a rational defendant would want to appeal or if this particular defendant reasonably demonstrated an interest.
The district court found, however, that the attorney did not fail to give him advice about appellate issues when the representation was considered as a whole.
There's no doubt that we have a hurdle on the second argument in that the district court found, made findings of facts as to credibility. I can't get away from that. We still believe we can win on the first issue when it comes to the standard that the judge used.
Well, the judge used the Flores-Ortega standard.
We submit that while using the Flores-Ortega standard, the judge inserted, separate from the standard which says don't consider what possible success you might obtain on appeal.
Well, that is part of the inquiry under Flores-Ortega, whether a rational defendant would want to appeal. I'm reading from the case now, for example, because there are non-frivolous grounds for appeal. So yeah. So the standard under Flores-Ortega really implicates that issue. So it was not improper for the district court to make that inquiry.
We believe there's a distinction between the Flores-Ortega standard, which says find out whether this defendant wanted to appeal, and did this defendant have a successful argument. We submit that the district court judge considered whether Mr. Bednarski had a successful argument.
You're referring to prejudice, I suppose.
Well,
no, no,
and I guess,
prejudice, because look, if this were to come up on, let's just say there was an appeal, typically cases like this will get an Anders plea, saying there's no legitimate argument. I don't really know where the line is drawn either, but it seems that there's lots of back and forth with the attorney, but nobody really said, you know, this appeal is hopeless or anything like that. I'm sure your client was disappointed, and yet nevertheless, everything's within the brackets of the the way the guidelines were.
Several things came to mind in Your Honor's statement. The first is, looking back over the briefs, I have to be frank that I was inartful in distinguishing between prejudice and prejudice. Prejudice as in he would have appealed, and prejudice he would have had a successful argument. But more to the meat, Your Honor's, more to the meat of Your Honor's statement, we would say now, I would say John Bednarski, if we were to do what we wanted, he wanted us to do when he came to us, and that is appeal, we'd argue, you know, maybe under Mikituik, if I'm saying that correctly, that he's able to overcome the burden under his particular circumstances, or even with respect to court, that standard's not appropriate because it may conflict with other circuits' opinions. And I know the Supreme Court's reviewing in a case named Rosa and another case that starts with a C that is not coming to mind right now, looking over whether that's the appropriate standard for an appeal. Now, did Mr. Bednarski think about those issues? Absolutely not. But we submit that he didn't get the counsel he needed to decide whether to expressly request the appeal.
There's no counsel didn't do appeals, therefore he wasn't.
And we think that at one point the district court judge said, it's hard to imagine any reason for Mr. Redfield would have for not representing, not responding to defendants' questions. We submit that it is pretty easy to imagine. He'd never done an appeal. He very occasionally did federal cases. He didn't, just off the top of his head, didn't know that the deadline was 10 days when questioned by government's counsel. It seems that he didn't answer because he didn't know. And we submit that at the absolute minimum, counsel needed to say, I don't know how to tell you whether you need to appeal or not, and then go ahead and just file a notice of appeal and have it be withdrawn later.
Mr. Brandt, at the hearing, was any inquiry made of whether Mr. Bednarski wanted to withdraw the plea?
No. And I know from discussion he did not want to. He did not want to. And we don't come before the court saying that the plea should be withdrawn or that the problem with the plea.
I'm just trying to get, if I can, into the mindset of counsel and defendant in the dynamics after receiving a sentence of arguably neither expected. So, and whether or not Mr. Bednarski was misled in any way by counsel, but apparently no inquiry was made as to whether he was misled as to this potential.
Not misled as to the fact that, look, this is the guidelines. This is what the judge may use in deciding how to calculate your sentence.
Inquiry could have been made. Did you say to the to the defendant, Judge Crabb would never give that? I mean, that kind of representation. I don't see any suggestion that kind of inquiry was made at the hearing.
I think instead the mindset goes to what sentence was he expecting. And I think that the questions we asked of counsel were more about, didn't you tell him that you were going to shoot for a probationary offense? Doesn't that mean no jail time? Didn't you say you were going to try to get a non-guideline sentence? Didn't you say that statement? And I asked the court to read the statement, how he said it. It's very, very likely that the judge is not going to impose a guideline sentence. They're meaning by negative implication that it's going to be less than the guidelines. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Brandt. Mr. Connell?
Good morning. My name is Paul Connell. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Western District of Wisconsin. I was responsible for both the prosecution of the defendant below and the representation of the United States at the 2255 hearing. This appeal raises two very straightforward issues. First, whether the district court erred as a matter of law when it denied the 2255 petition, and then secondly, whether the district court clearly erred when it found that the defendant's attorney had consulted with him. Turning to that first issue, the district court did not err in denying the 2255 petition as a matter of law. In the district court's written order following the evidentiary hearing, Judge Crabb applied the Flores-Ortega standard, so there really is no issue there. And unless there are questions about that, I want to turn, I think, to the more germane issue, which is the second issue. which is whether the district court clearly erred when it found that Attorney Redfield had consulted with the defendant regarding an appeal. This court reviews factual findings regarding the ineffective assistance of counsel for clear error. Here the district court did not clearly err. The district court made a simple credibility determination between the defendant and Attorney Redfield and found that Attorney Redfield had consulted regarding the defendant's ability and the issues he could raise on appeal from the outset of the case. That is, the evidence from the evidentiary hearing is that they talked about, by pleading guilty and in the plea agreement, by agreeing to the application of the sentencing guidelines, by fact-finding, by preponderance of the evidence, it would greatly narrow or eliminate any appellate issues. Further, the district court found that the defendant was not credible with regard to his version of events after sentencing. Specifically, the defendant claimed at the evidentiary hearing that after he was sentenced and felt that he got blindsided, they were in the car together driving back to Stevens Point, Wisconsin, and he inquired about appealing and that Attorney Redfield just ignored him. And as Judge Crabb points out in her order, she found that not to be credible. The defendant has a strong motivation to misremember events, and as she points out, Attorney Redfield, it's ministerial to file the notice of appeal. Furthermore, at the evidentiary hearing, Attorney Redfield testified at length that, in fact, he had previously filed a notice of appeal very recently in another case. He didn't remember off the top of his head that it was a 10-day time limit, but he knew how to file the notice of appeal. Furthermore, yes?
Does the record reflect whether there were any plea negotiations in this case?
There's nothing in the record. I can tell Your Honor, I represented the United States from, I took this case over from an AUSA who went on maternity leave prior to any charges being filed, and there were discussions back and forth.
Well, the reason I ask that, I wonder whether, as a backdrop to that, that was raised in the hearing. In other words, this case gives me not so much pause, but there's, to me, I'm wondering what dialogue went on between counsel and defendant immediately prior to the plea, and what formed the basis of whatever advice was given to Mr. Bednarski. And I was, you know, if it's not in the hearing of what the discussions were, I don't mean to specific numbers or anything, but whether or not counsel might have relayed his interpretation of the negotiations with the government and translated it into a arguably a strong recommendation that wasn't to be. That's all.
I obviously am not privy to what went on between Attorney Redfield and
court, right?
And there was there was no in the 2255 petition. There was no claim made about ineffective assistance of counsel with regard to the entry of the guilty plea. What I can tell you is, you know, the government's case was overwhelming. There was a search warrant done by the FBI and the local police.
Is this a counsel who regularly handles criminal cases in Madison?
There, I don't, on the top of my head, I think he testified at the evidentiary hearing that about 30% of his practice is criminal. Not a lot of federal criminal, but a little bit. He had had, I think, a jury trial in federal court not long before this case. I have more or less reached the end of my argument. I just would also like to point out, though, that Attorney Redfield testified at the evidentiary hearing that the defendant did not expressly tell him to file an appeal, but that Attorney Redfield told the defendant after the sentencing that if he wanted to appeal, essentially tell him to do so, and he would do it. And he encountered the defendant several times after the sentencing, and the defendant did not express any reservations at that point about what had happened. So I would just, other than relying on the brief, I have no further argument, and I would ask the court to affirm the judgment and conviction and the denial of the 2255 petition. Thank you.
Possibly starting in reverse with Mr. Connell's last statement that, yes, Mr. Redfield kind of threw the question back to Mr. Bednarski. Look, here's your opportunity. Tell me whether you want to appeal. If we're going to take that part of the testimony, let's look at all the testimony, and I'll get to what the judge thought about the testimony in a moment. But if we're going to look at that testimony, is, I said, do you want to appeal? Mr. Bednarski testifies that. Mr. Redfield says, I have no doubt that he asked me that question. Then he asks again, and then he asks again. And the only responses he's getting are silence, questions back, or, hey, I don't do appeals. Not here's the pros and the cons. And that's, there's no contradictory evidence in the record that there's no, it's either silence, I don't do appeals, or questions back. Questions back like, do you want to appeal? I don't know yet because you haven't actually answered my questions. When it comes to, if you just read the opinion and you don't read the statements at the evidentiary hearing, you miss this, that the judge said, Mr. Bednarski and you have not pointed out where there is anything erroneous about the sentence imposed. To satisfy Strickland, you really have to show that something would have been done differently, but it's hard to believe he would have appealed when I can't really see any issue on appeal. Once he accepts the concept of the guidelines, and he can't show there's anything wrong with the way the guidelines were computed, what's left to appeal? And that's why we submit that the wrong standard were used. And my time's up.
Well, you can conclude your thought.
Frankly, it was going to be another issue. So it wouldn't be fair to say that was concluding that thought. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Brandt. And thank you, Mr. Connell. The case is taken under advisement. And the